Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. No, I didn't get a role in Mad Men, but that AMC series is set in the advertising world of the 1960s, as many of you know, when, as Gail Collins put it in her book about second wave feminism, everything changed and women moved into ascendancy, leaving those rat packs in their dust. Well, Susan Jacoby was part of that movement, and she covered it. She started working at the Washington Post in 1965. She looks back on the men of that era in her new ebook just out called The Last Men on Top, which might be subtitled The Last Men on Top, An Appreciation. Hi, Susan Jacoby. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's lovely to be back here.
And you take issue with this view that men who fought in World War II and Korea had it all in the 1950s and early 60s, I guess because you saw in your own family the price your father paid for being the sole breadwinner?
Well, I think one of the reasons Mad Men gives, which I like as much as anyone, but it gives the wrong impression. Mad Men is about the 1% of its day. My father was an accountant. Our family got by because he worked for 3 months of the year around 80 hours a week in tax season. If my dad had interest in adultery, he didn't have the time for it. And you can replicate that with millions of men who had ordinary jobs. And all I have to say in this is there was a covenant then. We all know that. It was the man earned the money in the world. The woman took care of everything on the domestic side. The price of that was the suppression of women's ambitions, a story that's been very well told by feminists. But the price for men has not been talked about as much. And one of the prices for men was if you failed in your task, you had no backup at all. Imagine what the recession would have been like if women worked as little today as they did then. How many more homes would have been lost?
And even today, men's identity are often so bound up, their identities in their jobs, in their relationships to their jobs, that psychologists say men have a lot harder time than women losing their jobs in the recession and dealing with that emotionally. But listeners, did you experience the 1950s and 60s firsthand or through your parents' stories? Do you think the men of that era are getting a bad rap or well-deserved comeuppance in popular culture today, like in Mad Men? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Susan Jacoby, author of a new ebook just out called The Last Men on Top, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And you're right, for example, the last thing my father exercised was power. And you say he had less personal freedom than men do now. So if men like your father weren't running the show, who was?
Well, men who did had Madison Avenue advertising agencies, men who dominated the government far more than they do now. There were men running things. I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is the issue that gets pushed aside, as it always does in America, is class. Men of my father's social and economic class were not running much. And also, I think that there's something else to think about, which is the other price they paid was the lack of time with the very families they were working so hard to support. All of that cliche stuff about no one ever said on his deathbed, I wish I'd worked more. But it's really true. When my father was dying of lung cancer in 1986, he said over and over again, he wished he'd spent more time with us. I ask you, how could he? When she works about married women who worked was an absolute epithet.
So you don't buy the demonization of the regular workers of the Mad Men era, but neither do you buy the idealization of the greatest generation.
I don't. I hate to say anything bad about Tom Brokaw, whom I love, but Nate, you're not the greatest just because you were the right age to fight in a particular war, what Americans think of as the last good war. And by the way, the greatest generation got a lot out of that war. The vast majority who didn't die, they got VA loans at 4%. They got the GI Bill, one of the greatest things ever in American society. I don't think you become greatest simply because you were eligible for the draft.
Hetty, in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Hetty.
Hi there. I grew up in a family where both my parents were first-generation Americans. My mother, both graduated from college. My mother became a high school teacher. My father was an accountant. My world was populated by working women. And I think many of these conversations focus on wealthier women who didn't have to work or didn't want to work or weren't allowed to work. But many lower-level women and middle-class women worked throughout the 50s and 60s.
Actually, you're partly right, but partly wrong. Your world was different because you were a first-generation immigrant, and indeed, poor women, the bottom fifth to two-fifths of women, have always worked. The difference was in the middle class, in the middle fifth of women, almost very, very few worked in the 1950s and the early 1960s. A tiny percentage of women worked. But that's absolutely right. It was the middle class, and indeed it was an American ideal for people who were the earlier immigrant generation. If you were a second generation immigrant, as many of my parents' friends were, one of the ideals then for moving from where they were economically 30 years earlier into the American middle class was the wife, quote, did not work. The husband worked. It was not a good ideal, but it was an ideal of how you went from being first generation immigrant status to second. But you're absolutely right. And even today, the poorer, there's this idea that all hotshot women work today. In fact, women in the upper fifth of American families are not much more likely to work today than they were in my parents' generation.
Because they can afford not to.
They can afford not to work.
Choose not to at a similar rate.
Exactly.
Hetty, thank you for your call. Now, you're also taking issue in this book with a couple of Atlantic essayists, Hannah Rosen, and her writing in her book The End of Men, as well as Anne Marie Slaughter, who famously wrote about the problems of being a mother and having a high-powered career. So let's start with Hannah Rosen. Why isn't that narrative that men's power has decreased as women have moved into the workforce true as you see it?
It's not true as I see it because it's based on the idea that things were just great for this generation of men whom David Foster Wallace called phallocrats, borrowed from awful 1970s feminist bureaucratic kind of language. But Hannah Rosen is, again, bound by class. In fact, white men, upper-class white men, are doing really well in education. All of the things that people like Hannah Rosen say betoken the end of men. They're happening to men in the lower two-fifths. Again, class gets ignored. Hannah Rosen's friends, male friends, may not be doing as well as they imagined Don Draper was doing, although I think he's going to get his comeuppance pretty soon.
I think so.
But again,
but we're not here to do plot narrative.
Right.
And Anne Marie Slaughter, who was a very high-ranking State Department official under Hillary Clinton, she says that women are by nature going to worry about the children and men about the careers. And she did leave that State Department job to go home to New Jersey to help care for her teenager who was back here. But do you see that as a hangover from the 1950s?
Oh, please. Talk about a luxury problem. You move from being Hillary Clinton's top policy advisor to being a tenured professor at Princeton. This is exactly what I am not talking about in The Last Men on Top. These are luxury choices. And by the way, most of the people who are writing about this today, all of the how terrible it is, men and women with their confused roles and whether women think more about children than men do. If I were a tenured professor at Princeton, married to a tenured professor at Princeton, I don't think really that it's that bad. And Anne Marie Slaughter, who now has another big shot job, by the way, she stayed home for about about 3 months. But these are, and again, one of the points I make also is even young people for whom I have so much sympathy today who are having trouble finding jobs. But when people talk about the problems of the two-income family, they should have seen what the problems of the one-income family were when the one income was gone, which is what I grew up in Michigan, automobile industry. People worried constantly whenever there was a drop in automobile sales. If the man didn't bring the paycheck home, it was the end.
The new job of Anne Marie Slaughter, by the way, just recently announced she's the new president of the New America Foundation, the think tank. Bill in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi. This lady, I didn't catch your name.
Susan Jacoby.
Susan Jacoby. She pretty much hits a lot of the right notes as far as I'm concerned. My dad went into World War II. He went out of high school at 17. A lot of guys did that. Never graduated from high school. He was in the Navy on his 18th birthday fighting Japanese. He worked all his life, almost always two jobs, sometimes three jobs. And I was there with him. When I was about 10 or 12 years old, he started bringing me along on jobs in the evening. He would do electrical jobs, whatever, painting, whatever he gets his hands on, just to make ends meet. And things were very tough in the 50s and 60s for uneducated working men.
Bill, thank you very much for putting a personal story on that. And June in Rockland County, you're on WNYC. Hi, June. June, listen to your phone, not your radio. Hello, June.
Yes. One of the problems with these discussions about the role of men and women in the 50s and 60s is that it completely ignores the difference between the white community and the black community in the United States. The discussion is if this were an all-white society, and the roles of women in the black community, men, very different in that period than white men and women. And I think this needs to be addressed.
June, I couldn't agree with you more. And when you talk about the fact that the overwhelming majority of women in the bottom fifth of American families in terms of income worked, a lot of those women were African American women. And this is also true today, that the poorer families are, the more likely the woman is to work full time. And I think that it's not just about race. It's also a part of ignoring class as well, as if these people just didn't exist. And the middle class was not entirely white, but it was more white then than it is today. You're absolutely right.
And June, thank you. But if we revisit how much criticism men deserve for not sharing responsibility and power, what about when it comes to race relations at that time? Following your lead on sexual politics, do we then have to excuse adherence to Jim Crow laws by, you know, the large mass of average white people? I guess not, just looking at your face. You don't see a parallel. You don't see an analogy.
No, I don't. And, you know, and we could also talk about what African-American women did and the role of men versus women in the civil rights movement and who got more credit also. That's another discussion.
You write in the book that your 23-year-old niece is a big fan of Mad Men. What's her take as a millennial on that era?
Well, part of it, I was very pleased. I had hoped to write this book not just for nostalgia buffs in their 60s, but for people the age of my niece. And one of the things, when I had an excerpt published in the Daily Beast, I mentioned that when I was 18, I went to a doctor in East Lansing. I read about the birth control pill. I was very excited. And I told him I was getting married, my wedding night was coming up, and that's why I needed the pill. And he gave it to me, even though he didn't believe it. My niece could not believe that story, that you had to lie if you were an unmarried woman to get access to birth control at all. And that's one of the things, you know, with all this glamorization of dresses with girdles and men smoking and all of that. You know, this was also an era in which a woman had to lie to get birth control. So I'm not letting men off the hook entirely. I'm just saying that was a problem for men too, because male birth control was not reliable. I'm sure you remember those days.
Shirley in the Village. You're on, I'm not sure those days are gone. Shirley in the Village, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I came to New York at the very beginning of 1966 to work as an editor or assistant editor, because only women could only have assistant editor jobs, and a major magazine. And when the women's movement was going full blast, I was thinking, you know, I remain single. But I thought, what would I rather be? The guy who has all this responsibility, who has to commute every day, who's got this heavy-duty, you know, responsibility to take care of the family, or the woman who can pretty much do what she wants. Now, this is not how most women saw themselves, who lived in the suburbs and everything. But it was a hard choice to make. I sense evolved from that theory. But at the time, I used to listen to all these stories from these guys. I was one of the hated single women that worked with them, and you know, it was like. I mean, they had a lot of problems. Maybe it was all in their head, but they did.
And they thought their wives had it easier and had lives of leisure.
They did.
Painting their toenails.
Yeah. For a while, I was, you know, very sympathetic to them, but I changed my mind about that.
Yeah. I think Shirley is right about that, that they thought that their wives had it easier than they did. But I think that one of the problems here is that so much was veiled between men and women at that time that these men could imagine single women at that time. I started out as the Washington Post, same time you did in New York in 1965. There were two kinds of men who were in charge at the Washington Post. Some of them were totally baffled by women who wanted careers and were serious about them. Others helped. And in my last chapter in this book, I mentioned by name, unfortunately, a lot of them that were dead, the men who helped me and who told me something I needed to hear, which is that I had to be twice as good as any man to get anywhere, which you might think I should have known, but I didn't know then. And they were men who were able to change, even though they were products of these pre-war values. And I think that it deserves a remembrance, because there were no women to be our mentors then. There were only men, and some men did a really good job of it. Some of them were awful.
So ultimately, do you think families are better now than then, or are you just saying not so fast to those who want to pat themselves on the back for social progress?
Not so fast. Everybody likes to think that there was another time that was better. When I hear people in their 30s and 40s say, well, it doesn't count what we make because it's not a one-income family, I think you should consider yourself very lucky that you don't have to be a one-income family.
And we have to leave it there, but very provocative story on our views of history as we speak to Susan Jacoby about her new ebook, The Last Men on Top. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.